The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I've been thinking some this week about ethics, and ethics is generally the topic of how we behave, choices we make and how we live our lives. And some people in a more focused way look at ethics as questions of what's the right thing to do, what's the wrong thing to do, what's the ethical thing to do, what is it that somehow follows certain moral standards that our societies have, individuals have, and how does that work? And in Buddhism, Buddhism has an ethic, and certainly things to say about it. And it's been pointed out by scholars who have studied Buddhist ethics that Buddhist ethics generally doesn't have a philosophical underpinning that clearly supports it. And so in traditional Buddhism, there's no particular field of Buddhist ethics that can be studied. Whereas in Christianity, they had the Middle Ages, they had clear kind of areas and books and writings, and even in early universities, chairs for Christian ethics. It was a kind of clearly focused topic. And in Buddhism, it's never been signaled out in the same kind of central way that it sometimes people expect it to be, with a rationale behind it, support behind it. And people then try to articulate the philosophy underneath it and what makes Buddhist ethical, how Buddhism comes to its ethical conclusions. And one of the reasons why it's a little bit difficult to match Western understandings, ideas of ethics with Buddhist ones is that in the West, I think, more often than not, ethics tends to be very individualistic in focus. It has to do with the ethics of an individual more than anything else. So we have things like individual rights and obligations and duties of the individual. How is the individual supposed to act in any given time, and what are we required to do as an individual? And it's been pointed out that this strong emphasis on the individual that exists in a lot of Western philosophical thought is absent in Buddhism. Certainly, the individual agent who's doing practice and doing activity has some bearing. But the focus of thinking, the orientation that Buddhism tends to have, is not so individualistically focused. The idea of a very solidly or clearly autonomous human being, that's the organizing principle around which we find our life, seems to be not the way that Buddhism tends to organize or understand how we find ourselves in this world. And so the topic of ethics tends not to be compartmentalized as being a singular thing around a singular person. So a couple of ways to where you see ethics is kind of integrated into the wider kind of field of Buddhist teachings is a wonderful little metaphor for that says that just like the one hand. Like the right hand washes, when the right hand washes the left hand washes the other hand. And because, especially in the ancient world, when they're walking barefoot a lot or in sandals, they're washing their feet often, the metaphor goes on and says, just as if you wash the right foot with the left foot, and the left foot with the right foot. And when I was a monk in Burma, we walk barefoot, out in the streets. And then you would go into a building, and there'd be a basin of water that you would stand in, and then you kind of would wash your feet. You wouldn't bend down with your hands and wash your feet. You would kind of rub the feet together. So the ways that the hand and feet rub each other and wash each other. In the same way, ethics purifies wisdom, and wisdom purifies ethics. When someone is ethical, they are wise. When someone is wise, they are ethical. So here we have that ethics is not a subject that is treated in isolation, but something that goes along with wisdom, a person who's wise. And wisdom is not abstract wisdom in Buddhism, but wisdom also, why it's so closely connected, is that Buddha's wisdom has to do with how we live our lives. And so a wise person is someone who lives their wise. The definition that's wonderfully given for a wise person is someone who lives benefiting themselves, benefiting others, and benefiting self and others. And there's one more category, benefiting the whole world. So self, you know, certainly want to benefit the being that's here. You count just as much as anyone else. And then benefiting others, they count as much as you. And then the self and others, I take to be the we. We as a collective, whatever way to, whether it's a two people together or a whole community together. And then the whole world. And so the definition of a wise person is someone who has concern or lives for the benefit of the world, which is ethical in some way. And then ethics in Buddhism is also seen as going hand in hand with the third element at times, and that is spiritual cultivation. So there's these three parts of training in Buddhism. There's training in ethics, training in mental cultivation, developing ourselves, and there's training in wisdom. And those three are considered the three kind of tripods or pillars that support the whole Buddhist enterprise that we're doing. And so ethics is not, you know, if you have a tripod and you take one leg away, the whole thing falls down. So ethics is as important as developing ourselves, as important as the wisdom. So this idea of cultivating ourselves and developing ourselves is a very interesting topic that relates to ethics and to wisdom. And that is, if we take just a piece of what mental cultivation is in Buddhism, we take the mindfulness piece, mindfulness and concentration. If you start getting settled on yourself and have the ability to sit quietly, for example, so that you're not preoccupied and caught up in your thoughts and there's not a lot of agitation and spinning of the mind, and we're starting to become more sensitive to what's happening here psychophysically for us. Sooner or later, we might become aware, and I like the word sensitive to how we're tense, how we're contracted, how there's this kind of certain force inside sometimes of compulsion, wanting something really strongly. People who are just new to meditation sometimes are surprised by how much swirling and agitation and energy there might be to keep thinking, or tension in their body that's there, or contraction that might be in their heart. As people sit and get quieter, they get more sensitive. And so, as they get quieter, some of the surface agitation quiets down. But then slowly we go through layers in our body, mind, and we start becoming more and more sensitive to deeper layers inside. Deeper layers of contraction, deeper layers of ways in which there's compulsion or agitation, deeper ways in which there's a feelings of hurt, feelings of pain or ache or discomfort within us. And some of this deeper, when we get it deeper into the heart, deeper places of being, of aching or feeling somehow uncomfortable or feeling pain, is often connected to psychological forces we have within. So we have forces of greed, of hatred, of fear, of delusion, forces of regret, resentment, all these kinds of often with very deep feelings of who I am, if we're very identified, very caught up around self-identity and trying to be someone or protect oneself, some of that can be very painful to hold on to and to have. So as we go deeper in, we start becoming more sensitive not only to the inner, deeper discomfort and aches, but we also become aware of what causes it, what brings it about, what it comes along with. So if someone is, sitting quietly and meditating, and it comes a really strong desire to have something, and that desire begins burning, there's a kind of, maybe it qualifies as lust. And as a person gets more sensitive, they feel that that lust, that agitation, that burning of desire doesn't feel good in the moment. Initially, they might not be aware of that because they are so concerned with what they want. But if we keep settling and being mindful here, we start feeling how this strong, compelling desire feels kind of agitating, and we're kind of alienated from ourselves and not settled. It feels uncomfortable. And so it becomes relatively easy to feel or sense or have a almost like biological wish to not have this continue. It's like you put your hand on a hot stove and there's a biological wish to remove your hand. And it doesn't take a lot of ethical consideration to move your hand. You don't have to keep your hand there and pull out the Buddhist book on ethics and say, now which precept is this? And but you pull it away, right? So the same thing, it doesn't take a lot of teachings in ethics. No one has to tell you that you shouldn't be greedy. Greedy is not good. And let go of your greed, and if you want to be a good Buddhist, don't be greedy. But no one has to tell you that if you're practicing this deeper mindfulness, because then you start feeling deep inside, this doesn't feel good. This kind of feels off. And I can feel, I want this thing, and if I could just stop thinking about this thing that I want, I think I can kind of maybe settle some more, and I'll come home. I'll be more, it feels more comfortable, more satisfying to be here in myself. So we let go, settle that back. One of the advantages of this is that then if something comparable or the same greed pops up again, then there's a really clear contrast between the sense of well-being, the sense of clarity, subtleness that was there, and now getting agitated, now getting contracted, now getting aching that's happening again. And we kind of can see that, to use a dramatic language, that it is a kind of violence to ourselves to get wrapped up in greed and lust. Because violence in the sense that we are causing certain kind of harm to ourselves, an ache, a discomfort there. And if you see that contrast really clearly, if you come to a place of being kind of peaceful and settled, it's really obvious, wow, I was in a good place, and now I'm going to a place that's not so good. It doesn't feel comfortable. If we're swirling and agitated in daily life and just running around, our mind is chasing everything and thought that's possibly conceived of, and we're full of tension and trying to do things and accomplish things, a little movement of greed and lust is not a big deal compared to whatever else is going on. And so, it can even feel a little bit pleasant. The pleasure of the greed and the desire to have something can, in the context of being stressed out, might actually be a little bit of medicine. Some people, the way some people are. And so, and then people want to justify it, say, I have a right for this, this is good to do, and a little bit of pleasure is okay. And okay, it's okay. The Buddha gave a wonderful analogy. I don't know if it's wonderful. You have to decide. Apparently, I don't know if this is the case, but apparently when someone has leprosy, their skin is really painful and uncomfortable. And apparently, in ancient India, people who are lepers, in order to get some kind of relief, would burn their skin, would put their skin really close to fire. And that would give them some kind of relief. The Buddha used that as an analogy and say that once the person's healed, they wouldn't get close to the fire anymore because They don't need that kind of painful relief. So sometimes, you know, we're hurting so much already that we do things which are painful in and of themselves, but they do feel like kind of a relief. So people want to justify a little bit of pleasure is okay, and you know, I have a right to this kind of, you know, doing this stuff, whatever. But this amazing kind of thing that happens when we get really calm and settled and unagitated, peaceful, we become aware of the impact of our drives. So I use the example of greed, but also of hate. Start feeling, oh boy, why would I ever want to hate again? It feels so uncomfortable in my skin to be hating when I have this really good place to be. But there also, if the life is really stressful and people are not in touch with themselves, hate can seem like a very promising thing to have. It's a way of protecting ourselves, of getting what you want. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of, maybe even feels a pleasure of hate or something. Pleasure of self-aggrandizement or something that comes along with hating someone else. But it's kind of like leprosy, right? We're trying burning ourselves to get some kind of relief. But to settle. And then we see something. Say that you want to... So now in the news a lot is this all these men who are involved in sexual harassment, which is probably the mild word for it sometimes. And so some of the ways in which people engage in sexual misconduct, how much of that comes from lust? How much of that comes from some kind of delusion of grandeur and power, needing to prove oneself or be someone? How much of it comes from, sometimes sexual misconduct comes from hate and anger and aggressiveness. So the moral precept in Buddhism is don't engage in sexual misconduct. Just that. But maybe you don't have to teach someone that precept. You don't have to pull out the book and say, what should I do now? But if you are deeply settled and calm, then the motivations for sexual misconduct will feel like kind of a violence to oneself. Will feel like, oh, I'm off now. I'm not really grounded and connected in myself. And so, what's the ethics that arises out of a deep ethical sensitivity? And that's one of the things we're cultivating in Buddhism, is not ethical rules to live by the code so much, but rather we're trying to cultivate and develop a deep ethical sensitivity, which I would propose is synonymous with cultivating mindfulness. And that deep ethical sensitivity, deep mindfulness, kind of shows us what works and what doesn't work. Now, one of the things that doesn't work from this deep inner sensitivity is that it doesn't work to be selfish. Now, no one has to tell you you shouldn't be selfish if you're really, really settled and peaceful and you're not agitated and caught up in your thoughts and stressed out. Because you can feel in that sensitivity that movements of selfishness feel off, feel uncomfortable. And so paradoxically, this movement that looks like self-centered of turning the attention inward and really practicing well and deeply and really being mindful of what's going on in here, on the outside, some people see that as being selfish. You're just self-preoccupied. But the paradox is that if you do this, if you turn inward like this, to really feel what's going on, it is nominally maybe self-centered or self-focused maybe, but as you go in, any unhealthy way of being self-focused, of being selfish, starts feeling like, ouch. It feels like it hurts, it's just uncomfortable. And if you can feel that's an activity that you can let go of, you can settle further, then you can drop into a place where there's no selfishness operating whatsoever. No involvement or getting wrapped up in issues of self-identity. No fixation on the roles we have to have for our lives, how we have to image we have to project into the world. All that falls away. And then any kind of way of getting involved in those again feels like an ouch, feels uncomfortable. Why would you do it? Independent of, I don't care whatsoever about Buddhist ethics, like I might say to myself, don't tell me anything about ethics. I'm just going to do it my way. Okay, but just practice really deeply. So you practice deeply in your mindfulness. I'm not an ethical person. I just sit quietly and I'm very peaceful and very still. And I find out that because of that, I just can't get involved in hate or greed anymore. I can't get selfish, because just to do that, you know, just it hurts for oneself. You feel how off it is. In the dramatic language I used earlier, it's a kind of violence to oneself. So if we're not then wrapped up around, if the focus becomes less and less about me, then it makes more sense to that this sensitivity we're developing, this physical, mental, heartfelt sensitivity that comes with mindfulness, that it's a sensitivity that's not only directed towards oneself, but it's also directed to the world around us. If we're selfish, often there's a barrier to feeling and sensing and to empathy, to really being connected to other people and sense what's going on. But when we're no longer focused on being self-focused, you know, self-preoccupied, no longer caught up in self-aggrandizement or self-diminution, kind of the opposite end of it. When people are really identified with somehow seeing themselves negatively, but we're no longer playing the self game, and we're no longer preoccupied with hate or greed, delusion or fear, that ethical sensitivity that we have is not limited to ourselves, but also we feel what goes on around us. And that takes the form of compassion. We start feeling the suffering of other people. And the welfare, the well-being, the happiness, and the suffering of others can start feeling like it's almost like ours. Or say it differently, it's not, you know, it doesn't become something which is separate from our situation. It becomes part of our domain, part of our sphere, part of, you know, what's here. And it makes just as much sense to care for someone else as it does to care for oneself. And in fact, the direction of care is to go in any direction where there's hurt, where there's suffering, where there's, and if that happens to be here in oneself, that's just as important as it is for someone outside. But as we kind of move into this deep ethical sensitivity where this self-preoccupation fades away, there's no rule for when the attention is out into the world towards others and when it's towards oneself. It's wherever kind of the suffering seems to be most pertinent at the time, strongest at the time. So we care about others. Concerned with wise person concerned with the welfare of others. And then this wonderful idea of caring about self and others. I take that as the we, because sometimes when we're together as a with others, there's also kind of an entity of the we, the dynamics of the group that's there. And when we have a dynamics of two people who are closely connected or a small group that's connected, there's kind of agreements, kind of social contracts, kind of understandings, kind of group mind, kind of the more complicated network of understandings and relationships, and it's kind of like there's a we that's there. It's almost like a third entity. So how do we care for the we? How can I care for you? How can I care for me? But we're in this together, and how do we care for the system that we've created being together? And that's maybe for a more immediate community, who are the people we're with. So coming to IMC, for example, on Sunday morning, if you are, you know, there's this first early sitting that ends at 9:10, and so there's what you want. You've arrived at 9 o'clock, but it's cold out there, and these people are sitting. So what do you want? I want to get out of the cold, and so I want to go pee. So and you have, you know, clogs on. And so, and you know, it's all about you getting to the bathroom quickly and the warm quickly. That's all about you. And so you take your clogs and you clop across the wooden floor out there. No thought to what's going on in here in the hall. These people have been sitting for half an hour quietly and, you know, it's pretty calm and still. That's one way. Thinking about the others is think about what's in it for them, you know, to take care of them. They've been sitting for a while, they're still, it might be a little bit jarring to hear this loud wooden clogs pounding across the floor, and so maybe I'll take off my shoes. I do need to go pee, but maybe I'll take off my shoes at the door on the little carpet there, and then I can walk with my socks over, and they probably won't mind so much if I won't disturb them so much if I go with my socks. So that's taking care of them. And then there's a way of taking care of both self and other. Or maybe the better for taking care of them would be don't come in. Stay outside. If it's just about people sitting here. But about us, as a maybe it's just kind of finding a middle way, taking off the shoes and walking with the socks. Taking care of, you know, that's how we take care of us as a whole. And then the idea in Buddhism also, all this is mutually beneficial because self and other at some point is not seen as hermetically sealed and compartmentalized. So if you stay outside until 9:10, you might come into the building when they ring the bell at 9:10 and find all these beatific people. If you clomped across the floor, there'd probably be a little bit more agitation when the people who sat here, you know, when they get up, they need to go pee too. And so they might be a little bit more in a hurry, and one of them comes and cuts you off, because they have to go before you, right? If you stayed outside, they just kind of want to stay in their peace, and they'll take their time to go pee. So you benefited, they benefited, everyone benefits together if you kind of, you know, stayed outside. So it's probably not a good example, but I think that hopefully the principle you've kind of been illustrated, you can kind of make a better example for yourself. So the idea of mutuality. So it becomes clearer and clearer when we develop this deeper ethical sensitivity. So this does not make for a very good philosophy. And this is one of the reasons I would propose that Buddhism traditionally has not spent a lot of time putting down an under basis, a foundation of philosophy to support Buddhist ethics. Here in the West, people have often tried to see what form of Western ethics does Buddhism have? And is it virtue ethics? Is it utilitarian ethics, pragmatic ethics? You know, what kind of ethics is it? And lately, when Western scholars are trying to understand Buddhist ethics, now they're beginning to say it's all the above, depending how you look. It's all confound in Buddhism. But maybe one of the reasons why it's hard to kind of have a philosophy of Buddhist ethics, a rationale for why you should be ethical in Buddhism, is that we're looking in the wrong place for a rationale. Maybe the rationale is in your own heart, in your own deep ethical sensitivity, which is, if you don't have it already, it's waiting for you. It's there. And if you do mindfulness practice, generally people become more ethical because we are sensitive beings. And our sentience allows us to be sensitive to what's going on. And there's a tremendous amount of information available waiting for us if we're not preoccupied, if we're not caught up in things, if we're some modicum of peaceful and calm. And that inner information that it will provide the guidance to a great extent for being ethical in our lives itself. The challenge for us here in the modern West, or not the modern West, but in modern the world, is that our lives are now interdependent in ways that were inconceivable 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago in Buddhist India. And what it means to be a citizen of a society where that's somewhat democratic, where we're supposed to vote and pay taxes and do all kinds of things, that the issues of ethics, of how to live, what to do, becomes more abstract or more, you know, how do we take care of the whole world? How do we make decisions about capital punishment, euthanasia, cannabis, assisted suicide? How do we make decisions about the justice system? And how do we, you know, there's all these kinds of bigger issues that are societal issues. Do we go to Congress and tell all the men there, sit quietly and meditate? You'll get nice and peaceful and calm, and you'll have greater ethical sensitivity, and everything will work well. Do we have to, you know, do we have a need for some kind of consensus, some kind of agreed, shared understanding of a rationale for being ethical? When we have a more complicated society where it's, you know, so pluralistic in so many different ways. And that's different than just a one-on-one, you know, or closely and intimate, that, you know, our own individual decisions here and now and come from it. And so I kind of suspect we do. But what does Buddhism have to offer then in that kind of more abstract kind of societal way? Do we simply just say we have the precepts and we should live by the precepts? Do we talk about the great value of compassion and mindfulness? But those don't address the issues directly. Is there something that Buddhism has to offer for the wider conversation of our society as a whole that hopefully we can be part of? People often look towards religion for answers to these larger societal questions of ethics and behavior and what to do. Or does Buddhism separate itself from that and not provide answers to that, but rather some people say that there's a civic religion in America. There are other ways of coming to, maybe secular ways of coming to ethical decision making and criteria and rationale. So I'll end this talk by saying I don't know, which is very unsatisfying, probably. So in terms of personal ethics, I hope this talk pointed to something important and gave you some sense of why ethics and wisdom are so closely intertwined, ethics and insight. But then in your direct life that you live with other people, hopefully this makes a big difference and can make the world a better place to some degree. But then when we kind of step out of that into the wider social sphere, what is it that Buddhism has to offer? And so I think that what's happening here in the modern world is that Buddhists are trying to rise to that occasion. They're trying to articulate that, trying to understand that, trying to figure out what are the principles of Buddhism that underlie that kind of Buddhist ethical approach that would be supportive and offer guidance for how, at least for Buddhists, make decisions in these larger social issues of our lives. So it's in the last, I think, 20 years or so, there's more and more literature like this and more people trying to explore this. So either you're involved in it directly yourself, just because you're trying to make up sense of it, or you're waiting until someone comes along and can offer a really good Buddhist understanding for these things. And it's still a work in progress. So that was what I had in mind today. And we have the tea today, so we hope that all of you will stay and just chat and talk. Because remember, we're all in it together. It's a we as well. And if you wouldn't mind turning to two people next to you. Usually I say one person, but two people next to you. So just so little groups of three, and you can introduce yourself and say hello. It's welcome each other to IMC. And maybe each of you say one very brief statement about if this talk has elicited any interesting ideas for you. So it's just a brief statement so people can go if they want to go. So please say hello.